Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is veteran reporter and Pulitzer Prize-winning author David Shipler. Shipler was a foreign correspondent for the New York Times for over two decades and won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Arabs and Jews, Wounded Spirits in the Promised Land. But over the past two decades, he's been critically examining how Americans relate to one another and treat the marginalized in our society. Has led to a series of books, A Country of Strangers, which examined race relations, The Working Poor, Invisible in America, and his past two books on the erosion of civil liberties in our country, The Rights of the People, How Our Search for Safety Invades Our Liberty, and Rights at Risk, The Limits of Liberty in Today's America, which has just been released in softcover. In it, Shipler writes that a combination of anti-terrorism and anti-drug legislation and an increasingly acquiescent Supreme Court has led to a reduction in our overall civil liberties as compared to a generation ago. The book documents that reduction in police interrogation rooms, courtrooms, immigration proceedings, as well as the schoolhouse. Rights at Risk is published by Vintage Paperbacks, and David Shipler is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. David Shipler, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Very nice to be with you.
A lot of your writing over the past 15 or 20 years has involved what I'd call the other America. You're looking across racial divisions as one race views another, the working poor, and in at least the past two books, how civil liberties are upheld or administered increasingly by who you are or by who you are perceived to be. What has informed this overall reporting that you've been doing in your books?
You know, I spent many years overseas as a New York Times correspondent and wrote a couple of books about foreign issues, one about Russia, one about Israel. And when I came back to the States, I realized I was covering foreign policy, but I realized that what really grabbed me was talking to ordinary people in the country where I was living. And since I was living in my own country, I thought it would be interesting to try to unravel some of the vexing problems that we Americans face. So I began with race, as you mentioned, and went on to poverty, and then had the idea of doing a book on civil liberties and the criminal justice system that really crystallized after 9/11, because I thought, well, you know, our civil liberties are going to be tested now after this terrorist attack. It's going to take a lot of metal to stand up to our rights while pursuing security issues and make sure we're safe and free at the same time. And then, you know, that book actually ended up as a big, long book, too long to be one book. And so the book that's just come out now in paperback, Rights at Risk, is in a sense the second part of a two-part series on civil liberties. And I was surprised by the degree to which certain parts of the Bill of Rights have been eroded, not just by the war on terrorism, but even prior to that by the war on drugs. You know, the Fourth Amendment, which was put into place after the British used to execute general warrants and search whole villages and neighborhoods for contraband that had evaded tariffs and were brought in, requires a warrant to search, and that's really been shredded. In fact, a federal judge in D.C. who handles a lot of street crime, drug issues and gun crimes and so forth, told me that the Fourth Amendment practically doesn't exist in criminal law anymore. And that's a pretty startling statement from a federal judge. And this guy is no radical. You know, he's a very middle-of-the-road judge, but he sees cases coming through his courtroom all the time. And given the permissiveness that the courts have allowed law enforcement to do searches and to try to find exceptions to the warrant requirement in the Fourth Amendment, this is what he is seeing. The book that's just come out in paperback begins with Fifth Amendment problems. That is this is the amendment, to just remind everyone, that gives you the right not to be forced to be a witness against yourself. And that means that, you know, if you are arrested and you are in custody of the police, you can remain silent if you wish. That's your right. And out of that grew the Miranda warning, as you recall. Mm-hmm. This was a Supreme Court case in the 1960s, which really codified the police obligation to advise everyone who's in custody of his or her rights not to speak and his rights to have a lawyer and that sort of thing. So, you know, that warning does have to be issued. But what I discovered in the course of my reporting on this is that actually the police have learned and been trained mostly by one particular private organization, Reed and Associates, all kinds of tricks to try to induce people to confess to crimes by deceiving them very often. For example, the police can pretend to have evidence that they don't have. An officer who's interrogating someone can wave a piece of paper and say, you know, here are the lab tests that show that your blood was found at the scene. Or they can wave a DVD and say, well, this shows that the security camera recorded you being in the store at that time. Now, the police can't actually fake this evidence. In other words, they can't actually type up a phony report or doctor a DVD, but they can pretend to have it. And for people who are in custody who are either children or mentally defective in some way, retarded or mentally ill particularly, this can be very intimidating, and it's often combined with veiled threats or veiled promises. The police can't be too explicit. The courts won't let them say, well, we're going to let you off if you tell us this, that sort of thing. But children often get the impression, or given the impression, that they can just go home or they can see their parents after they tell the police what the police want to hear, or what they think the police want to hear.
You tell a story of one youth who woke up in the middle of the night and his parents had been savagely attacked, mother murdered, the father in grave shape. He calls 911. He's literally holding a pressure point to keep his father alive.
Right.
Once help arrives and the father goes to the hospital, you know, he's obviously stunned. And the police become suspicious because he's not showing any emotion.
This was a kid named Martin Tankliff, and it was in New York State, Long Island. And when the police came, Tankliff was so stunned, as you say, traumatized, that he showed no emotion. Now, the detective got suspicious about this, but obviously the detective did not understand the various manifestations of trauma, because one of them is an emotional shutdown, an emotional cutoff, and it's a defense. And often people who've gone through trauma show no emotion. So he got suspicious, and he started interrogating Marty, who was a teenager, and he began to not get anywhere with him. He got into intricate discussions of when did you turn the light, this light switch on, and when do you turn it off. And of course, Marty was covered with blood because he was, as you say, he was trying to save his father. His mother was dead already. The 911 operator was giving him instructions on first aid and so forth. And the detective wasn't getting anywhere, so what he did is he went into the next room where Marty could hear, and he used one phone to dial an extension that was also in that room, and he picked up that phone and he pretended to have a conversation with a police officer at the hospital where his father was, you know, and he said, like, oh, really? He came too? He did? He regained con- and he said that? He said that? Oh. So then the police detective hangs up the phone. He comes back into Marty's room where he's sitting, and he says, your father woke up and said that you did it. And Marty was completely baffled, and he, you know, because his father never lied to him, and he sort of said, well, gee, I mean, do you think I could have blacked out or something? And that gave the detective an opening to induce him to make what the experts call an internalized false confession, where the police, a skilled police officer, can kind of get you to believe that you actually did the crime, even if you don't remember doing it. And that's what happened. He made this false confession and immediately afterwards recanted, but it was too late. They introduced it at his trial, and he was convicted. And he spent many years in jail until people on the outside who really were trying to help him uncovered evidence that someone else had done the crime. Not sufficient evidence to bring a prosecution, but enough to get his conviction overturned.
Which was really interesting because the son immediately offered up that person as a suspect because his father and that person had been having arguments.
That's right. There was a business problem between them, and the son was suspicious that that might have been the person. He had been there, I think, the night before and that sort of thing. So the police are taught by the trainers to introduce the Miranda warning casually. You know, they say, by the way, you know, we've got this, you know, just sort of technicality we have to get out of the way. You know these rights. You know, you have the right to remain silent, have a lawyer if you want. You know, can you just sign this waiver and then we'll get this over with?
Yeah.
And often people will do that, not realizing that they're signing away, you know, really important rights. Now, the significance of all of this is that The Innocence Project has tracked more than 300 convictions that have been reversed based on DNA evidence. And mostly these are rapes and murders where there is DNA evidence. I mean, there isn't that evidence in all crimes, of course, and it's not even collected in many crimes. And a quarter of these reversals have involved false confessions. So that tells you, I think, if you extrapolate, that there's a vast landscape of injustice in the country that is produced by police methods and court decisions that allow the police to do this. I mean, the courts could tighten this up. Legislatures could tighten up the procedures as well. But they permit the police to use all kinds of tricks. I mean, that trick that the detective used on Marty Tankliff, pretending that his father had regained consciousness, there was nothing illegal about that under the case law. I mean, that is perfectly legal. You can do that. So that's a mistake, and that needs to be corrected.
Let me ask you, people listening are saying the same thing. You know, if you didn't do it, why would you ever confess? And yet there seems to be, because of the techniques, because of the amount of time that sometimes you're put in interrogation, people do sometimes falsely confess to a crime just to get things to stop.
That's right. I think it is counterintuitive. You certainly wouldn't think that, you know, if you're talking about yourself, you know, I would never confess to a crime I didn't commit. But first of all, a lot of the people we're talking about are children. So they're, you know, first of all, they've learned to respect adult authority, and you have one or two police officers who's telling them something and faking evidence and saying, well, your buddy said that you did it, and you know, there's a technique called minimization, where the police will say, well, you know, you probably did it in self-defense, right? Or, you know, it's not that big a deal. I mean, just tell us what happened, and, mm-hmm. you know, we'll be finished with this. So, you know, if you're a child or you're mentally retarded, you're much more susceptible to that sort of technique than a mature, mentally healthy adult, although they often confess falsely, too. And the other part of this is I think we underestimate the power of the sense of guilt, false guilt, that sometimes can be used. I mean, there was a very interesting experiment done of college students. They had college students sit at a computer and type some things and do some stuff on the computer, and they were told, if you hit the Alt key, you will trash the computer. It'll just, it'll just go down. And so, you know, you don't want to make the computer crash, so don't hit that Alt key. So they were typing along, and then, the technician, you know, made the computer seem to crash and said to them, you hit the Alt key. And at first the student said, no, I was careful, I didn't hit it. And then finally, you know, they would bring some other person in who was watching it, who would say, I saw you hit the Alt key. And most of the students began to believe that they had, in fact, done that. Hmm. That they were guilty when, in fact, they were not. So it's a strange kind of psychological phenomenon that's hard to get your mind around, but it does happen.
My guest today is David Shipler. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and his most recent book is the second part of two books that have looked at civil liberties in the post-9/11 era. Rights at Risk, The Limits of Liberty in Modern America is now out in softcover from Vintage Books, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, this book is much more than coerced confessions. You tell a lot of really sad stories in which, you know, attorneys representing a couple on a drug charge where the woman ends up going to jail because of a conflict of interest and the attorney helping the male. It goes into torture, which we think of as an instrument of foreign policy or anti-terrorism. You document a number of cases in America in normal criminal cases where this has happened, usually high-profile cases where there's lots of pressure to find a culprit. You're looking at the whole way of immigration law. And this all goes back to a central point, which as you write in the book, you said, you know, America's had many times where its civil liberties have been compromised, even within the first couple of decades of the country. During John Adams' reigns, we had the Alien and Sedition Act, where you basically couldn't criticize the government. You had the suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War by Lincoln. You've had numerous sedition acts around World War I. But the country always rights itself. Do you think something different is going on in this particular age just because of a convergence of factors where we won't right maybe some of the civil liberties that have been eroded?
Well, the difference now, I hope it's not a permanent difference, is that post 9/11 we're much more fearful, and I think our security, our sense of insecurity, we don't see a finite end to our insecurity and our risk because of terrorism. It's not like a war that ends, you know, with a peace treaty. This goes on, and I think that's one reason that there has not been a change in the surveillance policies. I mean, even by Barack Obama, who is supposedly a liberal president, although I think I actually see him more as a centrist than a liberal, you know, he has not really undone many of the questionable policies of the National Security Agency and other agencies that spy on innocent Americans. Even after the Snowden disclosures of the NSA documents, you know, there hasn't been a real reform. I mean, Congress came close to passing a bill that would have made it more difficult for the NSA to hold on to what's called metadata, that is, all the phone numbers that everyone in the country has called, which turns out to be collected, and the email addresses people communicate with, and the subject lines of the emails, by the way, that's also part of the metadata. But there hasn't been that kind of reform, and I think part of the reason is that we do still see ourselves as vulnerable, and no president who's commander-in-chief wants to be blamed for cutting back on security measures that may lead to a terrorist attack. I mean, but I would say, when I came out feeling about all this after many, many years of reporting and research on a whole range of civil liberties issues, is that this kind of conventional wisdom that we have to trade liberty for security, that it's somehow a dichotomy, that we need, you know, if we want more liberty, we're going to have less security and vice versa, is actually a false dichotomy because it doesn't really work that way. The framers of the Constitution were ingenious. I mean, they gave us a very clever system in which liberty and security are maximized. Just take the example of the false confessions we were talking about earlier. When the wrong person is arrested, the real culprit is still out on the streets. So how does that enhance our security? You know, when you take shortcuts past the Fifth Amendment or the Sixth Amendment's provision for an attorney, you actually undermine the protections not only of that particular person, but of the whole community. I mean, a very famous case of this was the Central Park jogger case, where a young woman was brutally beaten and raped and left for dead, although she recovered but remembered nothing about the attack, and five young black and Hispanic men were arrested and interrogated separately and confessed, even though they couldn't get the details of the crime right. I mean, they had the wrong time, the wrong place. There was no forensic evidence linking them to the crime. This was prior to DNA evidence. And, you know, they were convicted, and they spent years in jail until the real he was a murderer, actually. The real guy, a guy named Matias Reyes, who was in jail for another crime, confessed. And while these five were arrested, the police stopped looking, and this guy, Reyes, continued his rampage throughout the summer, attacking numerous women and actually murdering a pregnant woman. So that did not make the community safer. So I think, and in terms of the surveillance, I think, too, I mean, I've talked to many intelligence officers, mostly former intelligence officers, because the ones who are on active duty are reluctant to talk about this. But and they say that there's too much information coming in, that because there are really very loose limits on what the government can kind of collect about you, so much information comes in that nobody can sift through it. And they might have it somewhere in their, you know, in their computer records, but they miss it. And I think that's a very good illustration of the problem of violating rights and diminishing security. I mean, if there were stricter controls on what could be collected and some kind of prerequisite for having some suspicion first. The way a normal search warrant works, that is, you have to show probable cause that there is evidence that of a crime in a particular place. I mean, that's the requirement for a regular search warrant. And if you had that requirement before you started to monitor people's emails and web browsing activities and travel records and credit card statements and all of that, then you would have more focused information coming in to the authorities. And I think probably more effective prevention, which is really what we all want. That's what we want. We want prevention, which is, you know, it's hard to do that, but it's better to do it with focused surveillance than with this broad sweeping surveillance that we have.
In our last couple of minutes, the second half of the book really looks at more of free speech, civil disobedience, and how that relates in the classroom as well, in a little section on the classroom. And a lot of the examples you use are very egregious, but they were really immediate post 9/11 reactions, like somebody criticizing the president's Middle East policy in the days after 9/11, or and really knee-jerk reactions from law enforcement, both federal and local. Is there any sense that that is lessening now, or is there a sense that that sort of overreaction to free speech issues still exists?
Well, I think it's the spasm of alarm has passed. Yes, I think that is the. I don't think there are as many stories now about police officers arresting photographers who are taking pictures of bridges. You know, there was that kind of thing
yes.
going on. There's no law against that, by the way, but police officers decided that there ought to be, I guess, and they picked up a lot of people, tourists, photographers. So there's less of that, I think, yeah. In the other areas that I write about, particularly public schools, however, I don't think there's been change. The Supreme Court, unfortunately, has eroded the rights of students in public schools under the First Amendment, and they've given school authorities much more authority or much more power to censor newspapers, school newspapers, to suppress speech, and so forth. So there's a tug of war. I mean, there's also case law that protects those rights to an extent. However, the Supreme Court in the last, you know, 6-7 years has eroded some of that. So what you get is, you know, school authorities trying to avoid controversy by suppressing speech, by telling students they can't wear certain kinds of clothing with political messages, or organize certain kinds of clubs. And the students who decide to push back when this kind of decision is made often win their case. And often they don't even have to go to court because, you know, all they need to do is contact the local Civil Liberties Union chapter, and the lawyer there will write a letter to the superintendent citing the case law, and the superintendent will contact the school district's lawyer, and that lawyer will tell the principal, oh, you can't do that, you're going to have a court case. The trouble is that lots of students acquiesce. They don't know their rights, they don't fight for them even if they do know them, and there's a lot of peer pressure against making an issue of it. There was a case some years ago of a school district that decided to give random drug tests to every student who participated in any extracurricular activity. And young woman in the school, a student, decided to fight that in court, and she took it all the way to the Supreme Court and lost by one vote, I think it was, 5-4. And but the real penalty for her was that she was vilified by her peers in the school. I mean, you know, they just felt she was a troublemaker, and they thought she must be doing drugs if she objected to having a drug test, when in fact she was, as she put it, a goody two-shoes. You know, I mean, she was like, you know, straight as they came, but felt this was a violation of the Fourth Amendment because there was no probable cause to believe that evidence would be found. It was a random kind of test, and it was embarrassing because you would be called out of class in the middle of the class and asked to come to the principal's office, and everyone knew, or the nurse would come and say, come to the nurse's office. Everybody knew that that was what it was for, and so they jumped to a conclusion that you were suspected of doing drugs. So that was a very unfortunate decision by the Supreme Court, I think, because there was no rational reason for a drug test that could be linked to safety. I mean, there were drug tests done of athletes that were approved earlier by a larger majority of the court, but there was a rationale for that in terms of players possibly damaging themselves. Here, you're talking about the school choir, for heaven's sake. It was kind of a ridiculous decision. You know, that's the war on drugs. You know, that has nothing to do with terrorism. That's the concern about the rampant use of drugs among high school kids, and that's what I think led to that decision.
Well, I read very interesting the section on rights in schools, because as you well know, in here in Oklahoma, we have a case that will probably end up in the courts involving a fraternity member at the University of Oklahoma singing an abhorrent racist song, but the reaction from the school, expelling them from school, looking for others, could be a sense of overreach. And I'm already hearing from free speech advocates that says as abhorrent as the speech was, it still should be protected.
That's a very good case to look at, because you're talking about a state university, and the First Amendment restricts what government can do, not what private entities can do. So if it had been a private school, unless there was some state law protecting, you know, restricting what the school could do, there would be no question, I don't think, about that. I mean, the school would have the right to expel the students for speech, just as an employer, a private employer, would have that right. However, in this case, it's a state school, which means the First Amendment comes into play. But there's a tension between the First Amendment and the law, which provides, and I think it's Title IX, which provides that schools must maintain I can't remember the word exactly, but there's a good adjective, a learning environment that is an environment that's conducive to learning and does not discriminate against any particular group. And I would imagine, I'm not a lawyer, so I may be off target here, but I would guess that the University of Oklahoma will cite that in its defense and argue that this video created an environment that was hostile to a whole group of students, namely African Americans, and therefore that the university was within its rights to take such action. But you're right. I mean, there's a tension there, a conflict, and the courts will probably end up having to resolve it.
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting book, Rights at Risk. David Shipler, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate your doing this.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author David Shipler speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. The second book in his examination of civil liberties in America, Rights at Risk, The Limits of Liberty in Modern America, is now published in softcover from Vintage Books. By the way, the third volume of his examination of civil liberties, Freedom of Speech, Mightier Than the Sword, comes out in May. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.